Hello, and welcome to a new episode of SAHA Conversations, a podcast by the Scottish Arts and Humanities Alliance. SAHA, in short. In this series, we celebrate arts and humanities across Scotland. We bring together arts and humanities enthusiasts from different industries, from business to design, from politics to media, and of course, academia. Wherever their careers might have led them, they all share a passion for arts and humanities and recognise their important contribution to society. Today we're joined by Dr. Brianna Robertson-Kirkland, Associate Head of BMUS at the Royal Conservatoire of Scotland and a member of the editorial board at Scottish Universities Press. Thank you for joining us. You have a very interesting job title. However, I am conscious that some members of our audience may not have heard the word BMUS before. Could you please explain what a head of BMUS does?
So I'm the Associate Head of BMUS here at the Royal Conservatoire of Scotland. So I have two colleagues, that's Sam Ellis and Steve Happyard, who are the heads of the BMUS program, and I work alongside them. Basically, our capacity is running the BMUS program, which is one of the largest programs here at the Royal Conservatoire of Scotland. In addition to that, I trained as a historical musicologist and I specialise in 18th century music, specifically 18th century singers and singing.
Oh, that sounds very interesting. What is exactly a historical musicologist?
So we look at the history of music, and I particularly look at singing, singing training, what singers have been up to, what they have done. And my most recent project, which is looking at the Corrie family, who were an Italian family that emigrated to Scotland, and looking at how they worked and operated their businesses at a time when things were really growing and booming as a result of the Enlightenment in Scotland.
That's very interesting. Part of our audience is made of ECR, or early career researchers, and also a younger audience. And I'm sure they would love to know more about your education. What did you study to become a historical musicologist?
So I initially did my BMUS degree at the University of Glasgow. I specialised in performance and I am a singer, so that's why I'm so interested in singing. I then went on to do a master's in historical performance, which was a joint master's between the University of Glasgow and here, the Royal Conservatoire of Scotland. Again, I focused more on performance, but I did have the opportunity to dig more into the research as part of that master's programme. Before I then went on to do a PhD back at the University of Glasgow, where I specialised in the castrato singer Venanzio Rauzzini and how he trained his students, which then became the subject of my first monograph.
You also worked in the AHRC-funded project, the edited collection of Alan Ramsey, and Alan Ramsey, the Tea Table Miscellany, co-edited with SAHA co-chair Professor Murray Pittock. Could you please tell us a little bit more about that?
So the Edge Collection of Alan Ramsey was a multi-year AHRC project that allowed us to bring brand new editions to the market of Alan Ramsey's work. Alan Ramsey was known as the father of the Scottish Enlightenment. So he was an early 18th century jack of all trades. More than that, it was a embedded in a lot of arts and culture in Edinburgh and really pioneered poetry, song, theatre, multiple things in Edinburgh at the beginning of the 18th century. The Tea Table Miscellany was one of his most popular and biggest collections that he produced, where he gathered songs from the past, songs that he had written himself, songs from his friends and colleagues, and he compiled them all together in a printed collection, which was then produced and reproduced across the 18th, 19th, and even into the 20th century. It was really the first song collection that was produced that really inspired Robert Burns just about 50 years later.
Would you call this a multidisciplinary research project?
It was. So we, I came in as the music expert. Murray has multiple expertise in history, literature, Scots history. And we had to work very closely together to understand what was going on with the Tea Table Miscellany. The rest of the team also specialised in literature, music and Scottish culture to pull together the rest of the collection that was being published.
That is fantastic. That's very interesting. Let's move on to open access. because this podcast will be released on Open Access Day or Open Access Week. What is Open Access for our audience that may not be familiar with this name?
So Open Access is making academic work freely available for the wider audience to be able to have access to and to consume. Those who are unfamiliar with academic publishing may not know that the production of academic books and journal articles, if you want access to that information, it typically comes at quite a high cost. It's not just freely available online. It's also not something that you can just go to Waterstones and pick up. Certainly not for the types of costs of books that you might expect, which might range from £12 to £20. Academic publications tend to be more in the range of between £80 to £150, maybe even £200. Now, there are perhaps some reasons behind that. They tend to be small productions of books, and so publishers will argue that they have to offset those costs by charging a high sum. But when it's all wrapped into a person's academic position, perhaps it's all tied in with what they're expected to do at their institutions, and the person producing that work themselves are not actually benefiting from those costs, it becomes very difficult to start to justify that kind of cost and that kind of price, especially when we tend to be trying to encourage our students to purchase those works, as well as fellow researchers, so that we can be in conversation with one another.
Earlier, you talked about all your roles at the Conservatoire, but you also have a role in the Scottish University Press. Again, some of the audience may not be entirely familiar with Scottish University Press. So can you tell us something about Scottish University Press and your role within Scottish University Press, please?
Of course. So Scottish University Press was set up just a few years ago. It was intended to be a cost-effective model for open access publishing. It's the largest library-led publishing collaboration in the UK. It was actually set up with 18 member institutions who were part of SCIRL. And SCIRL is the Scottish Confederation of University and Research Libraries. They all came together with this ambition to try to make open access publishing more accessible and more cost-effective, as well as maintaining high quality of publications. This is intended to be giving people as much opportunity to publish open access without incurring those high fees, high costs that are traditionally attached to other forms of open access publishing.
And what is your role within Scottish University Press?
So I am one of the members. So my specific role is that I represent small institutions like the Royal Conservatoire of Scotland, but also the Glasgow School of Art. And I'm in the first instance bringing a voice to the table of what small institutions such as us require, as well as reviewing and looking at those books that come through to us that are seeking publication in this open access platform, and discussing how we can push things forward at Scottish Universities Press, if we can dive into more publications, how we can make it easier, more cost effective for academics, and also how to encourage early career researchers to come and publish their work with us.
You mentioned smaller specialist institutions and ECRs. So how can open access publishing and the Scottish University Press be beneficial for ECRs and SSIs?
So ECRs have historically struggled with trying to find platforms to publish their work when they're right out of their PhD. There is a bit of a step from completing your PhD and then trying to get that work published in either academic journals of high quality or as a monograph or a book. And so often ECRs, they are searching for positions as well as trying to publish their work, as well as trying to polish their work. And they're doing all of this outside of the safety of having a supervisor there to constantly provide guidance. Now, of course, there may be ECRs who are able to turn to different people for support, but usually they are away from an institution and they're not able to do that. If they do find opportunities to publish their work, and say they get their first monograph and they're wanting to publish it with a large press, which would be wonderful for them, they then have that question of, should I publish it open access? Open access is soon likely to be a requirement of REF, which is a research excellence framework that most researchers based here in the UK have to go through every 5 to 7 years, roughly. This is usually connected to institutions, but there are also institutions who will base their hiring on someone's REF performance or how many publications they have that are REFable. And it looks like they're going to have an open access requirement for large-scale publications. They have one currently for smaller publications such as articles. Now, if someone's not connected to an institution, what do they do? Because there are presses who are going to charge them quite a lot of money for gold standard open access, and that might be their only route if they don't have an institution in which they can deposit their work that's open access and by another means. At Scottish Universities Press, we're trying to create a model that's cost-effective so that ECRs who are not connected to an institution might have the opportunity to publish their work that is still open access.
I assume that would be very helpful for SSIs or any institution that is smaller in size.
Absolutely. So here at the RCS, we're very encouraging and supportive of people publishing their work. But again, we are living in a challenging economy, and there really isn't the funding there to be able to support, say, someone's large-scale monograph with a large-scale press that are asking for thousands of pounds to be able to support that and that publication. If I was to do that, I would have to go and find funding from elsewhere, and there's precious little of that, and there's very little of it that's specifically supporting open access publishing. Scottish Universities Press does still incur a cost, but that cost is much smaller, and they are quite supportive of trying to find ways to make it then financially viable for those to publish with us.
Thank you. Obviously, Scottish University Press is not just for the SSIs or practice-based institutions. So who can publish with the Scottish University Press, and how can they do it? So how does it work? Do they just email you, or do they email the general email address? How does it work? What is the process?
So they go to the website and they will find their guidance for authors, which explains how they may be able to put together a proposal and submit their work to us. It then goes through an administrative process where everybody's checking that all the right material is being provided before it is then sent for peer review. Once the peer reviewers come back with their guidance for the board then review that, and we will take a decision on whether further work is required, whether we can proceed to publication, and we'll provide that guidance back to the author. So all of the information is available on the Scottish Universities Press website if anybody is keen to submit their work to us.
Thank you. We will link the website address in the description of this podcast episode. So as we just mentioned, Scottish University Press is for everyone, not just for practice-based institutions or arts and humanities faculties. How many books have you published so far?
So we have 3 books that have been published so far, and we have 4 that are forthcoming.
So far, we mentioned the name quite a lot, the name Scottish Universities Press. So do all the submissions have to be from Scotland or about Scotland, or can anyone submit their work?
No, they certainly don't. So we have publications that look at a variety of different aspects from a variety of different geographical locations. So it certainly doesn't have to be Scottish focused or Scottish based. Of course, there are those publications that do have a Scottish focus and they are welcomed, but there is also publications welcomed from any geographical location.
Well, you mentioned you're a member of this. Some of our audience, they may be interested in the editorial board. Can people apply for the editorial board? Does it change every so often? How does it work?
So currently the editorial board is full. We have everyone who's required for the board. Every so often, as a board member leaves, then there will be an advertisement that is put out for a person to fulfill a position. So that was how I got onto the board, was that an advertisement for someone who could come and represent small specialist institutions was put out, and I applied and was chosen for the position.
Well, that is brilliant, and congratulations. I hope you're enjoying your role on the board.
I am, very much.
What are the challenges in publishing in open access for practice-based research rather than literally-based research?
So typically, practice-based research produces publications that are not literary-based, so they're not written text, which tends to be what publishers and open access publishing focus on, is the written word. But in a small specialist institution such as the RCS, we have a lot of composers. And even in my role as a historical musicologist, I produce editions of music. And music, in particular, has a lot of challenges with copyright and who owns that music and how to be fairly represented when you are producing that music. So that presents a number of challenges for publishers because there are kind of all additional considerations of creative license and who needs to be credited and how that work is then fairly compensated for. It's a challenge in the open access model because it's trickier with music and it's trickier with art production. Like, these are things that tend to have a lot of personal investment. And that's not to say that literary-based texts don't have personal investment too. They absolutely do. But it can sometimes be seen as quite different from something that is an academic piece of literary text. And there are different rules and different laws that are attached to music copyright. So these are things that need to be carefully considered when we are thinking about open access publishing.
Obviously, AI is present in everybody's life nowadays. We all interact with AI, whether it's with your phone, with your Google Assistant, or you use ChatGPT to find a recipe for something, or some people may use it to write papers. We do not condone that, but some people may do that. How do you think the rise of AI will influence editing work and writing work?
Well, we can already see that there's quite a hefty amount of influence imposed already. Anything I Google now, you get the Gemini response that immediately pops up. And it's so easy to just go, oh, okay, well, that must be it, rather than to think more critically and think and deeper into where is that information actually coming from. So my work on the Corys, there is work by others that have been published, but I'm one of the first to be finding and identifying new information about the Corys. And obviously I'm going to conferences and I'm publishing abstracts that are appearing online. So recently when I put in something into Google to find out a piece of information about the Corys, lo and behold, what popped up in Gemini was exactly my words that I'd written for an abstract. And I suddenly went, oh, that's just pulled exactly from me. I didn't give permission for AI to do that. But it's sourcing from all different parts of the internet. So this becomes very tricky for researchers because certainly my work at this stage with the Corys, I'm still finding and discovering new things. I'm at the point of presenting my work, but I wasn't necessarily at the point of it being up there, upfront, factual information that people can just uncritically take and use for whatever means. And yet it's kind of presented in a way that my students, for example, might assume that is the facts, that is the information. This also becomes a lot trickier when we are now seeing that there are certain presses that are asking for researchers to sign to allow for their work to be used for language modeling through AI. And it's going to become much more difficult to maintain intellectual property to a certain extent, at least that's my opinion on it. Because how do you opt out of something that is inevitably coming for us? I don't really have an answer or response for that, but it does make me think very carefully about how I want to produce my work, which presses I want to work with moving forward, how I protect my intellectual property and the information that I'm finding, and what we do with AI as we move forward.
So we mentioned the ECRs, our literary researchers, quite a bit. You also work with undergrads. So if you could provide three pieces of advice to ECR looking into open access publishing, what would you suggest?
So first of all, for early career researchers, I would say make sure that your work is of sufficient quality and ready for publication. I remember that feeling as a freshly minted PhD or PhD graduate and feeling the pressure to get my work published. And I was sending it here, there, and everywhere. And it was heartbreaking to get some really quite critical and cutting feedback. Now, at the time, that felt like the worst thing in the world to me. But on reflection, looking back, it actually helped me to grow, to help realize where I needed to take those steps that moved me beyond being a PhD student and into now a working ECR. So look at books that have been published. Look at the way in which that writer is constructing their argument and think about how your work moves beyond the PhD before you start thinking of something like a large-scale publication. So that'd be my first advice. My second advice is find a press that is going to be useful to you. So presses that have, say, published work that are similar to the work that you are looking at, presses that maybe have support for open access initiatives, if that's something that you are keen for. And be mindful, if you are wanting a position within an institution, of what they are looking for in terms of refs. So for small-scale specialist institutions, we have a requirement here at the RCS where everyone who's research active is going to submit to the REF. And so that means that even ECRs coming in are going to be expected to have some kind of REF submission. That just might sound a little bit scary, but it might help think a little bit more strategically about your plans for publication and open access routes. So that might mean, thirdly, that looking for presses that are going to support ECRs through cost-effective models like Scottish Universities Press might be the right kind of press for you.
That is very interesting. Thank you very much for this wonderful Saha conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on this Saha conversation. We hope you enjoyed it and learned something new. If you like this episode, please like, subscribe, and share it on your favorite social media platform. You can tag Saha on Instagram at SahaVoice, Blue Sky at sahavoice.bluesky.social, and LinkedIn and Facebook on Scottish Arts and Humanities Alliance.